With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
My guys are still under a judicial estrangement order. That blue thing I got from her.
I've got the best lawyer soft tacos can buy.
Objection.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor?
I think legal terms are magic words that can force people to do what I want.
My client has instructed me to remind the court how rich and important he is, and that he is not like other men.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 405. Well, this episode is found, Andrew. That's good. So we got past good. That particular error. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Fine. Yeah, we can't get into it. No time. So doing well. we've got more bad news to talk about, I think, unfortunately. But, you know, I'm sure, as always, Andrew will be here to optimist prime us into feeling a little better. I think that's why a lot of us listen to the show. So we're going to talk about Trump versus Bob Vance of Vance Refrigeration. I don't know why I made that reference. There was no way Andrew was getting it, but it's an Office reference for anyone who doesn't remember. And then we're also going to talk about an awful John Roberts thing that resulted in killing someone who didn't know why they were even there. So that's cool. And then I just see in all caps bar exams. I don't know what that means. Yeah. Just the status of them in under COVID. Is that
correct?
Okay.
Correct.
I shouldn't read into the all caps. That just seemed exciting. More exciting. We'll see. Well, maybe it is
bar
exciting.
Bar exams.
Woo! Bar exams. I don't think I have any announcements. How about you?
No, let's get it rolling.
Well, shoot. Let's just get right to it then.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
So you're not aware of any contacts during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia, to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please.
Okay. You were feeling optimistic about this whole Vance situation, so let's hear it. Let's get more into your optimism.
Yeah, so I want to break down the briefing and the status conference that occurred last week, last Thursday, in Trump versus Vance. And again, right, this is in light of the remand ordered by the Supreme Court. This is the case that went back to the Southern District of New York. And the question is, how quickly is Cyrus Vance going to get Trump's taxes from Mazars? And, you know, we dealt with, I don't even know that we dealt with this on the show. I certainly felt like a bunch of people raised in social media, in emails to us, on the right, on the OA Facebook community, in Twitter. There is a non-lawyer wrote a book about Cyrus Vance dropping certain investigations in New York 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah. I'm curious because that didn't seem great, but I know it doesn't sound like you subscribe to any sort of conspiracy theory stuff about it, but do you not think there was, well, why don't you explain it a little more? And then I'm curious your opinion on if you think there was some corruption going on.
Yeah, my opinion is that it is virtually impossible to second guess declination decisions unless you have really, really good evidence. And in those circumstances, what I want is evidence from an impartial lawyer, right? Because look, I know I've never been a prosecutor. I know a lot of prosecutors. I've worked with current and former prosecutors, and you can always second guess a decision not to prosecute a case. And so that to me, like, that just doesn't rise to the level of being a red flag, particularly as I pointed out, like, the converse of this, right? Like, you know, and people, you know, sort of were like, well, you know, you thought Bill Barr was going to be fine too, right? To which I would say, you know, okay, good one.
Fair.
Right?
Yeah.
Fair. Right? In fact, I did reply
one
fair.
Your,
I think
probably your one. Biggest yeah. blunder. That's okay.
It is a big blunder. But remember, the context around Bill Barr that I said was, this seems like an institutional, like, good old boy George H.W. Bush era Republican, right? Now, look, some of those people were monsters, right? Like Dick Cheney was in the George H.W. Bush White House. That's not to suggest you're not going to be a monster. It is to suggest you're probably not going to be a Trump co-conspirator. So I was totally wrong on that. He turned out to be and has turned out to be the primary Trump co-conspirator at this point, right? Like this... Again, I've now said this on multiple occasions, but like this disaster of a criminal enterprise that is the Trump administration would look very different if Jeff Sessions were still Attorney General. So, you know,
what a world we live in where Jeff Sessions is not right wing enough for the Republicans of Alabama anymore.
Is too ethical. Well, yeah, I love that too. Can we rabbit trail that for a second?
He lost his prime. Is the weirdest. What a story that whole thing. I mean, obviously,
it's so great.
No one can or should or is or anything shed a tear for Jeff Sessions. Never. But like, also, what a Shakespearean story. It's incredible. Yeah. Racist, first one to embrace Trump. First senator, I think, to embrace Trump, right?
Absolutely. Goes in there, first sitting senator.
Makes the critical error of having just a modicum of, I won't say decency because it's not that, ethics, sort of, like an instinct to go with the rules as they've always existed. You know, like he just kind of, Jeff Sessions just kind of flinched, like, oh yeah, I'll go with how the rules are supposed to be for a second. And that cost him everything.
Yeah.
He lost his primary to somebody with a made-up name who's a football coach, Tommy Tubbs Tubers something.
Tommy Tuberville.
Timmy.
I love everything about the story.
It is unbelievable.
So not only is it great to see Jeff Sessions, who exactly the way you described, right, came out and then, because it's a Republican primary in Alabama, basically had to do the Ted Cruz, right? Like get on his back, put all fours up in the air and, you know, roll over on his like, you know, and say, oh, well, I still love the president in every conceivable. I mean, it was so transparent and so demeaning to watch Jeff Sessions kind of trade whatever shred of dignity he had remaining for a chance to get back in the Senate, and then for Trump to endorse Tuberville and to wipe the floor with Jeff Sessions.
It was not close.
Yeah, it was.
But but the other part of it is, though, before everybody's like cheering, yay, Jeff. It's like, no, he lost to someone more Trumpy. Like it's worse. it's not better.
It's not. Here's the thing from political considerations, right? Like this is the inverse of the 2016 presidential election, right? Which is to say, when the underlying demographics favor your opponent, you want the highest variance candidate that you can, right? So if you're Doug Jones, you have a huge uphill battle to win re-election in Alabama. Jeff Sessions would have won 55-45, right?
Because notwithstanding
the fact that like Trump didn't endorse him in the primary, Trump would have endorsed him in the general election right? Like, and all of those Republicans would have voted for Sessions, and Sessions enjoys huge statewide popularity because Alabama, you know, is a garbage state. Go ahead, write us in if you live in Alabama. We'll take it.
And by that, we don't mean every individual living in these states are garbage. Just they're states that are under Republican control, you know, like like Georgia, which is now currently they're banning bands. That's a garbage state, not because of the people in it per se. There are a lot of good people, which is, I mean, under the control of garbage people is all I'm saying.
Exactly right. So, look, already out of the gate. So here's what we do know. Jeff Sessions would have been a very low variance candidate. He's been in the Senate forever. He's held statewide office in Alabama for 25 years. He is known, and he's a Republican. And I think he would have beaten Doug Jones, even in a what I anticipate will be a blue wave election year this year. Tommy Tuberville may turn out to be a disaster of a statewide candidate. He's never run statewide before. And already, if you don't follow Alabama Democrats on Twitter, you should follow them.
I know, I saw.
They are amazing.
Pretty great, yeah.
And again, none of it may matter, right?
Yeah.
But you want, right? It's just like when I can back this up, when the Republican primary was down to Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, I said very explicitly, I want Ted Cruz to be the Republican nominee because Ted Cruz is a way lower variance candidate and the underlying demographics favored Hillary Clinton, right? Like, there was no doubt in my mind, Ted Cruz could not have won Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Right. And there are no other states that he would have picked up that Trump won. Right. So Trump won because of his high variance status. And it is possible that this is still an underdog race for Doug Jones. But I feel better about his political chances today than I did, 2 weeks ago. And B, I love the as you put it, the Shakespearean quality to that. So,
well, while we're on the topic of your biggest blunder, which was Barr, I will say this because I'm very much a fan of trying to be accurate and not misrepresent anything. I believe that when the Republican primary was first going, in 2015, early 2016, that kind of time, I think I was saying that Cruz is such a known evil that he might be worse than Trump, whereas Trump, I didn't know what he stood for because it was all BS. And I truly underestimated just how deranged he would be at first. I think I quickly changed that view as the campaigning went on. But I think I want to own up to the fact that I think for a while I thought Ted Cruz would be worse than Trump. But anyway, what a weird thing. So but what I wonder too. Oh, the last point I was going to make is, maybe it's better for Democrats, assuming this Timmy Two-Toe Tuberville is going to win, whoever it is. Assuming he wins, maybe it's better to have someone who's likely going to be completely incompetent in the Senate. Maybe not true for the presidency, as we've learned. You might want a competent Republican to be president over an incompetent one just because of how important the position actually is. But in the Senate, what's an incompetent Republican? It would be better to have an incompetent Republican, maybe, than to Jeff Sessions, but I don't know. Maybe it's all the same because McConnell controls everything anyway. So
that was our kind of sidebar on the fitting end of Jeff Sessions' national political career. Let's have a Viking funeral, and now we can talk about the specifics of Trump versus Vance. We got off on that sidebar by the question being raised in liberal conspiracy theorist circles of, well, maybe, Cy Vance isn't going to be aggressive in prosecuting these crimes. And I now have three. I did have two answers to that. I now have three, right? My first answer was, you're misreading the Supreme Court's opinion if you think it only applies to Cyrus Vance, district attorney of the state of New York, right? Like the opinion applies to law enforcement generally and is a great opinion. So there's no secret Roberts did this because he knew Vance was going to go. That is fillings in your teeth broadcasting secret messages to the Illuminati level nonsense, right? The second was that Cyrus Vance is a lifelong Democrat with obvious political ambitions. And so notwithstanding whatever decisions he made on declination in the mid 2010s, if he would be dead as a Democrat, right? Like his political career would be over as a Democrat in New York if he failed vigorously to pursue the Trump criminal real estate charges.
Right. Well, that's the other thing I was thinking, like, even in a worst case scenario, which is Bob Vance of Vance Refrigeration is totally I'll never not think of that. It's such a funny part of The Office. But anyway, even if Vance was just totally corrupt back when this first happened and he got a donation in exchange for declining, whatever, like, if that were true, that would obviously be awful and it would be awful. But people are very self-interested, and it could entirely be true that while hypothetically, again, which you seem to think is unlikely, but hypothetically, if there was corruption initially in this decision back, what, 7-8 years ago, that things are different now, that it might be like, well, the entire world is watching this right now. Like, it's literally his name is in the case. You know, the circumstances are not the same. I wouldn't find this like, even if the worst case story were true about 8 years ago, I wouldn't even think that would mean the same thing would happen again here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And now you can add a third argument to it, which is that this at this routine scheduling conference, I will tell you that Vance's office, now this was argued by an assistant prosecutor, Carrie Dunn, this was as aggressively litigated as any status conference that I have ever seen. Okay. And let me explain why that is, right? So we all know the game on the Republican side is to delay as much as possible. That was on full display during the status conference. Let's take a step back. The point of a status conference is to set deadlines, right? So the court, the Southern District of New York, sent a request to the parties and said, hey, by the 15th of July, submit a joint status report on setting scheduling deadlines. And the parties did that, and they came to an agreement on the expedited schedule that I described last at the beginning of the Friday episode, right? And that expedited schedule, again, is Trump to file an amended complaint by July 27th. That's this coming Monday. Vance's motion to dismiss would be due a week after that on August 3rd. Trump's opposition would be due a week after that on August 10th, and then Vance's reply would be due 4 days after that on August 14th. That is a blazingly fast schedule in legal terms. And again, you know, as even with the resources of Vance's office in the district attorney's office in New York, like, that's fast, okay? And the parties agreed to that schedule, and then the judge scheduled a hearing to discuss how to set all of the deadlines. And I'm going to cut to the chase, right, which I did last Friday. Ultimately, he agreed to the party's schedule, but not before saying on the record, I don't know why you gave me a schedule that took more than 6 days from start to finish, right? Huh. That is Judge Victor Marrero of the Southern District of New York, keenly aware of what the government strategy is.
Yeah.
And then I will tell you, Casey Dunn replied to that and said, Your Honor, we are open to a shorter schedule than what's contained in the status report, which delightfully set off Bill Consovoy, the president's, I think I can say, incompetent and ill-prepared lawyer on this. Hmm. So the point of the hearing was to set those deadlines. It very quickly turned into a debate on the merits because the Trump administration's desire to delay was on full display, right? So the judge kind of went through and was like, hey, what do you need time to do here, right? What is it you say you do around here, right? And and Consovoy was gave as bad an answer as, you know, Bob gave or who is it, the jump to conclusions Matt got, right? Like, yeah, like, he gave as bad an answer as you got in office space, right? He was like, repeatedly said, the president has not yet determined which arguments that he wants to make. So Judge Marrero said, look, the way I see it, you've got three different kinds of arguments here, right? The first is the breadth of the subpoena. I think I've already ruled on that. The second is, was there bad faith and harassment? And is there a specific standard here as to how that would interplay with the fact that you're the president, right? Is that retaliation against the president? Are there Article II separation of power concerns? And Consovoy's answers were basically, I don't know. I'm not kidding, right? He said the president is still reviewing the subpoena and has not decided which arguments he'll raise upon remand. He said that on multiple occasions. Meanwhile, Vance's office answered those questions super cleanly, said, Your Honor, you're going to need to see new arguments in order to determine overbreadth, and you've already made a determination that the subpoena is not overbroad, and that the Supreme Court very clearly stated, and this is 100% correct, this is part of why we said it was a victory, that the standard for review of a subpoena directed at the president in this particular case is the same as any other American citizen, right? That is to say, there is no unique defenses available to the president because he's the president. That's what this whole case was about at the Supreme Court, and that's what the Supreme Court rejected. I want to add, because I love this, Judge Marrero asked the following hypothetical. And by the way, a shout out to Jen Taub, who managed to transcribe this word for word in her Twitter feed. So here's the hypothetical question. Suppose a hypothetical district attorney possesses documentary or testimonial evidence showing that entities or people associated with a hypothetical president engaged in criminal transactions that could impact the hypothetical president. And suppose the hypothetical district attorney believed this could provide sufficient grounds for an indictment or an exculpation. How should the DA, the hypothetical district attorney, proceed in bringing this information to the court's attention? So I love that. And Consovoy gave the only answer you can give to that hypothetical, which is in-camera review, right? The DA should turn all of that evidence over to the judge, and the judge gets to look at it. And essentially, like Dunn gave, it's the only question that's sort of hard for Vance's office to answer, because Consovoy is going to say all of this stuff needs to be shielded. And Vance would love for all of this to be part of the public record. And so Dunn's answer was, Your Honor, if those pleadings needed to be filed under seal, then we would be willing to file them under seal. But, you know, that's the best answer you can give on the other side, right? So ultimately, that's what will happen, is that the subsequent pleadings will be filed under seal to the extent that they reveal information about the president, right? Like the turning over of the actual records. But I listened to this hearing, and I will tell you, the DA's office is taking this very seriously. They fronted the argument for the district attorney's office, right, in front of the court on multiple times, that said, hey, let's not let delay kill this case. Justice delayed is justice denied. And his concluding statement was, our office's position, Your Honor, is bring it on.
Wow.
And let me discuss how that interacts with the conspiracy theory argument. If you are Cyrus Vance and you are prepared sneakily to drop this case in exchange for the brickloads of money that Trump is going to give you, or whatever the theory is saying.
We never would have even been to this point, right?
Of course not, right? There have been a billion opportunities for you to drop this. And right now, all you would be doing is saying, like, well, Your Honor, we understand that there are important concerns, right? Like you would just agree to delay, because that would be a far better outcome for you, right? Like you could still pretend. It's like the fighter taking a dive, right? Like you don't come out when you're the boxer taking a dive, you don't come out in round one, walk up, and then like, you know, you get one hit in the stomach and you roll to the ground theatrically like it's a soccer match, right? Like, you know, you gotta punch back, you gotta make it look like a real fight. And the ideal solution would be to say, yeah, no, we're totally fighting, you know, we're going to come out, but sorry, time just ran out, right? Like that's what you would do. And the fact that they're not doing that should give you confidence that this case is aggressively moving forward. I'm 100% convinced of that now.
You know what? I'm as optimistic as you are on that point. But it also sounds like the court is having none of this delay tactic None. Stuff. Yeah. So, you know,
it,
all right.
It final briefs due August 14th. The court gets to rule immediately thereafter. And I suspect this judge will be ruling within a week. Right. So end of August. And then the subpoena, 30 days to comply. Mazars will turn over those documents. You know, if there is an effort to litigate up a stay, the time to gather the documents will still run while they're litigating out the stay.
Right, right, right.
And those will be heard by the, like, because those will be emergency motions. So those will be heard by first the Second Circuit and then the Supreme Court. And neither court is going to come in and issue a stay here, right? If and again, you're thinking the Supreme Court, but like, look, this was a 7-2 decision at the Supreme Court, right? Like, they are not going to stay when they've said that this is a fact-specific inquiry. That's clearly too far for John Roberts.
I'll be curious if Mazars or whoever it is, if it's the other one, Deutsche Bank or whatever, are they going to use that full 30 days? I'm just curious. Could they just be like, no, we're ready. Here you go. Or it sounds, I mean, it doesn't seem like they've been making that much effort to try to give up their prized clients' documents.
Yeah, they could do so in a way that was confined to this case to say, yeah, man, like, look, usually you get the 30 days because you have to talk to your client and gather documents together, right? Like, that's the hard part. And they could say, like, well, yeah.
You've had a century to gather these freaking documents.
Right, yeah, exactly. We know the documents. They're all in a file. And the only question is, are we legally required to turn them over?
It should be in a draft email ready to just hit send with the attachment on it or something, you know? I wish the judge would be like, you don't need 30 days. You need 3 days. You don't need time for this.
It is entirely possible that because counsel for Mazars was present, counsel for Mazars, I should say, added nothing, right? Said counsel for Mazars takes no position on the joint status statement, right? And was also present at the scheduling conference and had nothing to say, right? So, but absolutely, Judge Marrero could interrogate counsel for Mazars and say, you know, when he issues his ruling and say, all right, does Mazars need 30 days to comply with the subpoena? Why? Well, how come you haven't been gathering the documents over the last year and a half? I'm going to give you 5 days. I'm going to give you a week. Absolutely within the court's discretion to do that.
Okay. And, but next question was, maybe last question, all of this result, like, say, okay, your timeline's right, and somewhere in August, September, whatever it is, this the documents go to Bob Vance, Vance Refrigeration. Do we just see a sealed indictment and then end of story? And then Trump says, what a corrupt guy, a sealed indictment, it's nothing. And then it makes no difference, or am I being too
negatron? No. Like, look, there are two options. Sealed indictment that is then executed when Trump leaves office on...
Which is still great, don't get me wrong, that's still good. I'm not, but in terms of affecting the election.
Yep. That would absolutely affect the election. The other way around it is to
Hold on. Do you think it would affect the election for real?
If the Southern District of New York has indicted the president in a sealed indictment, absolutely.
I'm pretty sure the Southern District of New York has told, was it just Don Jr., but I thought Donald Trump as well, that they can't run a charity anymore because they stole from kids. And that makes no difference to anyone. So. Well, part of the complicated part of this question is that already his chances are really, really, really bad. So, I mean, it's one thing to talk about now. Like, it may be that this won't affect the election because already he's lost the people that this would lose him. So that's one answer to this, maybe.
Well, that's right. And so we're talking about, right, the overwhelming evidence has already brought the kinds of people to whom Trump misused a charity. I think that's different than conduct that we may discover has extended through being in office as the president of the United States. I could be wrong on that. And also the evidence might not support that, right? Like I don't know, right? This could all be, you know, 2000s level conduct. Certainly the New York Times article was talking about conduct that, you know, goes back to the 1970s. So, maybe I shouldn't have been so cavalier as to say I absolutely think it'll make a difference. But I also think, like, we saw from 2016 that that attention is, right? Like what's being discussed is also a powerful influencer, right? And if, like, in the weeks before the election, what we're discussing is, you know, is Donald Trump guilty of real estate fraud? Like, I would rather that be the discussion than, you know, whatever garbage they're going to be leveling at Joe Biden, right? Like, and look, we are going to have weeks where the discussion is, you know, is Joe Biden senile? Is Joe Biden, you know, a secret pedophile, right? Like, I mean, we're going to have those weeks. And so having that not be one of those weeks, I think is, you know, is good in terms of what the focus is. So,
all right. Did you go through all the possibilities? I'm sorry if I stopped you. So we could have sealed indictment. Was there another thing that could maybe happen? Is there any way we get our eyes on this?
Yes. And the other possibility is public indictment with an unindicted co-conspirator, a John Doe, and that John Doe is listed as President-1, right?
Listed like, as, unknown yeah. person, yeah. John 300 Doe, pounds with tiny hands.
A John Doe, right,
vague description.
His description
spray
is.
Spray tan, wears a toupee, just tiny hands, stuff like that. Yeah, you put it together.
A hereto unknown president of the United States of America. Yeah.
Yeah. It's friggin' Jimmy Carter. I knew it. Finally, we're going to get him.
There you go. Yeah, we're going to get him for that peanut farm. So, but yeah, those are your options.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no. I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
Time for our main segment. Andrew, why is John Roberts still the worst?
John Roberts is still the worst, right? We did episode 400, John Roberts is Not Your Friend, that both responded to and anticipated the wave of truly terrible takes about the Supreme Court's term, in which it's like people are falling for, I mean, just the most obviously bad, right? Like, so if our thesis is John Roberts is a conservative activist who is concerned about the institutional legacy of the Supreme Court, therefore, he can be shamed when the activism would be so naked and so transparent as to cause the public to lose faith in the Supreme Court as an institution, and therefore is inclined to depart with the howler monkey contingent that does not care in those cases and only in those cases. All of our available evidence supports that thesis, and yet all of the journalistic hot takes are like, oh, look at how liberal John Roberts has become, with one extended cluster of exceptions, right? And that extended cluster is Professor Leah Litwin, who I am trying to get on the show. She hosts her own podcast. She is amazing. And she was quoted as a source for a 538 article that backs up her analysis with data. I'm going to link it in the show notes. That was brought to my attention. By the way, shout out to Jeremy Riffle at Jem Riffster on Twitter. It's the best piece 538 has written in a year. And I say that not just because it supports my, you know, not just because it supports my thesis, but because it's like what it's the kind of stuff that 538 was supposed to do, right? It's like, Oh, the conventional wisdom is X, so let's look at the numbers. And I recommend
at the data.
Everybody, right? And I recommend everybody read it. I'm going to give you the top line takeaways, right? So the one I retweeted out with the article, quote, in the vast majority of cases, Roberts appears to be basically as conservative as he's ever been, end of quote.
Right? Shocker. Yeah. Shocker. No one here at this podcast could have told you that except both of us here on this podcast.
Except, right, both of us all the time. So what about all the things that like show how John Roberts is moving to the middle? And basically what they say is, okay, couple things you need to know. Number one, whenever you have a data set of 9, somebody's going to be in the middle, right? Mm. And being in the middle of a data set of 9 does not equate to averaging out, right? Like being the median does not equate to being the mean, right? Mm. And then they talk about like Roberts breaking with the howler monkey contingency. And they contrast it with Anthony Kennedy. And I thought this was also where they interviewed and quoted Leah Littman. Littman points out that with Anthony Kennedy, he truly had some iconoclastic beliefs, right? There were a few areas in which Kennedy, by the way, fairly doctrinaire conservative, but liberal on gay rights and moderate on abortion. And so, in other words, when you looked at political issues, you would expect to see the Roberts, Alito, Scalia, Thomas, then conservative bloc, hand down doctrinaire conservative positions on gay rights and abortion, which they did, right? Mm-hmm. Again, we've mentioned Roberts's strident dissent in Obergefell. But Anthony Kennedy was liberal on gay marriage and sided with the court's liberal bloc to then swing the court over into issuing a liberal decision in Obergefell. Here, I'm going to read directly from the 538 article, quoting Littman. Roberts' swings, on the other hand, are driven by more strategic and even political considerations, quoting Littman. Quote, he's concerned about maintaining his own power and the power of the court, said Littman. It was perhaps a sign of Roberts' success that some of the biggest conservative victories this term mostly flew under the radar, such as when conservatives continued to expand the circumstances under which religious schools can qualify for public funding, which we talked about in episode 4 or 3.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Littman and others said that Roberts could follow a similar blueprint for eroding something like abortion rights in the future. Rather than overturning precedents outright, he might prefer to whittle away at abortion access by allowing states to pass a patchwork of restrictions until landmark precedents on abortion eventually became functionally hollow, which, by the way, we've been telling you is the game plan since 2017. So glad to see 538, glad to see Professor Littman on board. Go there. Go get the numbers. And final line, he's not really a wild card, especially compared to Kennedy, who was genuinely unpredictable on a handful of issues. A better description for Roberts might be the pivotal justice, the person with the power to broker compromises between left and right. But there is no support for the thesis that John Roberts is more liberal than John Roberts has ever been. He isn't. And the game plan should still be to shame John Roberts. And to illustrate that, I want to talk a little bit more, because this truly angers me, about the Perkey decision, Barr versus Perkey. As we pointed out, this was a grant of a stay in the middle of the night. And when you hear a grant of a stay, you're like, well, wait a minute. Like, don't you have to stay the execution? Here's what happened. Okay. Wesley Perkey, 68, suffering from Alzheimer's, filed a petition for the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. He is incarcerated in Indiana, but he is incarcerated for a federal crime. And so he will be executed in Washington, D.C. So filed a petition in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia pursuant to a Supreme Court decision. That Supreme Court decision is called Ford versus Wainwright, and it's a 1986 case, which says that what you have to do is you have to establish a threshold of factual circumstances to entitle you to an evidentiary hearing to show that you are mentally incompetent to be executed. He went to DDC, and the court held that he met that threshold and so said, okay, we're going to stay his execution and we're going to hold a hearing to determine his competence. That's what this is about, right? This is not about letting him go. Mm-hmm. That's about, should we investigate whether this person is mentally incompetent to be executed by the United States government? The government then appealed that directly to the Supreme Court, because this is one of those rare procedural things with death where you get to do that. And in a 5-4 decision, per curiam, so no majority opinion, only dissents, right? And I'm going to talk about both sets of dissents in a minute.
Does that mean they didn't have the guts to sign their friggin' names to this thing and actually write about why they want to kill a person who doesn't?
Correct. Yeah. Just stayed the effect of the district court's decision, which then allowed the execution to be carried out. So that moots all the rest of the stuff on the merits because, you know, now Perky has been executed as of the time that the show was recorded.
Wow.
So let me first talk a little bit about the evidence. Psychiatric evaluation late 2019 that he lacks a true understanding or rationality that the murder is the basis for his execution. There is extensive evidence that Perky earnestly and steadfastly believes that the government plans to execute him not as punishment for murder, but in retaliation for his, quote, protracted jailhouse lawyering to expose prison abuses. That's in the psychiatric report. Mr. Perky has a fixed belief that he is going to be executed in retaliation for his legal work to prevent him from being a hassle for the government. Consistent with such evidence, individuals have described Perky's, quote, history of delusions, hallucinations, and paranoia. All of this is not to say he definitely can't be executed, but is to say maybe a court ought to have the power to hear evidence from both sides as to whether this is somebody who truly understands why he is about to be executed.
Right. And you know, before, I'm sure some people out there are thinking, ah, oh, what if this is flimsy? What if he's faking it? Whatever. This, correct me if I'm wrong, but this decision would have been handed down by the Supreme Court as though they're taking for granted that he has no idea what's going on, right? Like that they didn't,
yeah.
Weren't the facts not under dispute?
Correct. That is exactly.
So this bad decision would apply if literally someone, you know, like aliens come down and wipe someone's memory. Like yeah. that would still fit under this decision because it's like, we don't even care. We're not even going to have a hearing about it.
And again, that's the answer, right? Like if you think he's faking or malingering, then prove it, right? At a competency
hearing. Or let
hearing,
him prove that he's not, I guess.
Right, well, that's the thing, right? I was just about to say that. At a competency hearing, the burden of proof is preponderance of the evidence, right? It's which side gets to 50.1, right? It is not, right? The burden of proof is not beyond a reasonable doubt that you understand the reason why you are about to be executed, right? So there is no presumption of innocence at this point. All it is what does the judge think is more likely, that this guy understands why he's going to be executed or that he doesn't understand why he's going to be executed? And if you can't reach that level, right? And again, it ties go to killing him, right? Like
that's America's new catchphrase. Ties go to killing him. That's a good, that's pretty much America in a nutshell.
And the Supreme Court said no. And as bad as all that is, and that's really, really bad, it gets worse because, and here I'm quoting from the dissent, but I have reviewed the pleadings on the application for stay, and this is a correct summary of the argumentation. I'm just going to read to you from the Sotomayor dissent. This is the four-person dissent. Importantly, the government does not appear to dispute that Perky may advance his competency claims in a proceeding in the Southern District of Indiana. And now let me give a sidebar. So yes, the government's primary argument here was, oh, you filed this in the wrong court. I wish I were lying about that. Okay.
Sorry, you're dead.
Continuing. It identifies no procedural barriers to such a suit. Indeed, the government proposed below that the district court transfer the case to the Southern District of Indiana because, in the government's view, that is, quote, the appropriate forum for Perky's habeas action, end of quote. It is thus undisputed that there is a district court in which Perky may properly pursue his Ford claim. And again, it's called the Ford claim because the Supreme Court case was Ford versus Wainwright, 477 U.S. 399 from 1986. And his request for a competency hearing. So let me unpack that for just a second. And again, I want to describe the actual strategic considerations on both sides, right? For Perky's lawyers, they looked at the situation and they said, well, he's incarcerated in Indiana. He's going to be executed in the District of Columbia. We probably stand a better chance at getting a more sympathetic judge in D.C. than in Indiana. It 100% that calculus entered the room, right? It would be, I do not want to pretend otherwise.
Hmm.
But I also want to tell you, like, lawyers do that kind of stuff all the time, right?
Right.
Like, lawyers on, like, you figure out if you could bring a case in multiple fora, you figure out the best possible place in which you could bring it, and you bring it there. And they brought it, and they got a stay. They got a stay of the execution and an order that a competency hearing be held. Now, had the Supreme Court decided to uphold the stay but transfer the case to Indiana, I wouldn't have any arguments here, right? And
right.
And I would be taking the headlines and saying, no, right? I'm sticking up for John Roberts here, right? This is actually procedurally fine. It's mm-hmm. it's probably true that the better forum for raising a habeas petition is in the jurisdiction encompassing where he's currently incarcerated. That I want to be honest with you. That's probably the better procedural argument. If John Roberts were the secret moderate that people are pretending he is, that's what he would have done. That is not what John Roberts and the conservative majority in this court did, because this majority does not want to afford future criminal defendants additional procedural rights. That is the only reason for the result in this case, which is on a procedural argument saying, oh, well, you know, sorry, too bad you didn't file it in the right court. Oh, well, better luck next time. Oh, wait, this guy's going to be executed. That's not flippancy coming out there. That is anger with the result, right? Like, this is an indefensible result. The idea that this would get Alito and Thomas, yeah, right? Yeah, Alito and Thomas are, you know,
they never met a defendant they didn't want to kill or something, or a convict right. they didn't want to kill.
Yeah, right. I expect pure evil from that segment. But this is the majority of the court's ruling. And again, overturning the district court. So saying that the government's argument is so strong as to be indisputable, let me not be hyperbolic. Saying that the government has met the standards, right, for substantial likelihood of success on the merits to overturn the district court's decision in this case, which that's just not true, right? Like it is not true that the law is that strong, and that the appropriate remedy here is making sure nobody ever gets to make that determination, because that's what's happened now. That's the end result. Nobody is going to make the determination as to whether Mr. Perkey understood why it was that this country wanted to kill him. And I have to think we have listeners, we have a liberal audience. We have to think we have some who are pro-death penalty. You and I have been very staunchly anti-death penalty. Regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, if you don't want that bare minimum of protection, if you don't want a criminal defendant to at least have to understand why he's being executed, I can't understand how a thinking human being gets to that perspective, right? Like, there is no justification for punishment, right? Deontological, Kantian, lex talionis, utilitarian, right? Like, none of them can support executing somebody who doesn't understand why he's about to be killed.
And they didn't even say, like, okay, we get that you tried to forum shop a little bit. We're going to put a stop to that and try again. They just said, you tried that and now he dies because you tried that. We didn't agree with it. I mean, I don't know.
You have to infer, because again, the majority gave no written opinion. They just.
Oh, right. Yeah. They didn't even tell us what they think.
They didn't tell us.
Wow. Not a fan of John Roberts. Not a fan.
Yeah. Don't tell me John Roberts is a secret moderate or a secret liberal.
Well, this is a really frustrating one. That's a shame. This is real bad. And I really hope we can do something to fix the court.
I have a plan for that. So we'll roll that out. So I guess we're going to wild card the bar exam segment. Here's what I want to say in 5 seconds about that. I'm going to include the NCBE, the National Council of Bar Examiners, link in the show notes, just like I did last Friday. If you are planning on taking the bar, check it out. Lots of jurisdictions, and it doesn't necessarily track, you know, red states, blue states. Lots of jurisdictions have gone either to online bar testing in the fall or alternative arrangements. We're going to do a show on this in the future. Didn't get a chance to do it today. Sorry. but most people who are taking the bar are busily studying the summer get a reprieve probably until September or October. I want to talk about the story, but not today.
And thank you.
All right, and now it is time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats on patreon.com/law. Hope they're enjoying the benefits. Yeah, again, a lot of awful movies. If you haven't listened to it, go catch it. It was a lot of fun. Legal action, which contained almost no action. Maybe none. And we are thanking this week the Great Dooku Tree. Awesome. I assume general Zelda reference, but specifically, I think Ocarina of Time, my favorite game like ever. Thomas Kleberg, Bradford Keaty, Mary Perez, Ann Schmeckel, Proceed on Your Way to Oblivion, Amicus Flinch, Dan from Deerfield, No Shortage of Dicta in My Briefs. We firmly stand for the proposition here on Opening Arguments that we are 12 and we'll always laugh things like that. My Intro to Law Cases Are Real Property 2020 just keeps giving. Well, I can help you out with that. Need any tutoring, let me know. It's 5, 6, 7, open up them pearly gates. Ain't no time to wonder why, whoopee, we're all gonna die. Shut Up and Take My Money, William Drew Collins, Bob Newhouse, Sassy Italy Tours Decided Devin Nunes Was Too Stupid for Just One of Our Wine Tours, Greg Kreimer, Montana Liberals Matter, Give Me Daily Episodes or Give Me Death. Well, we hope John Roberts is not deciding that option, that question. I was granted a writ of certiorari and thought it was permission to see the Northern Lights. I guess Murder Hornets were just a filler episode. Cheeky Breaky. TheMulletShirt.com. Button-down dress shirts with awesome designs on the back. Check them out. Colleges expecting students to social distance are delusional. Mike Hall. Yolam Tam. Mergers and Acquisitions, Religious Corporate Conversion Division. Hornbook's Law is a primer. That's pronounced primer, you ninny. It's not paint. Walking the line between legal advice and legal education since 2016. Nice. We accept that. Samuel Bland. Fly Like a Hot Dog, Freedom Eagle. Angry Macface. More Codenames live streams. This is not the greatest Patreon name in the world. No, this is just a tribute. Say it with me. Amicus. No. Center Black Trans Sex Workers, the Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. The What's It About podcast, a happy place for book reviews and author interviews. This episode was brought to you by the letter Q for quarantine, a string of impeachable characters, each more impeachable than the last. Wear a mask, it's polite. Come to Minneapolis for the future live shows. Stay because of the seemingly inevitable second lockdown. This Patreon name paid for by the Lionel Hutz for SCOTUS committee. He's more qualified than Brett Kavanaugh anyway. Haney Maxwell, Benghazi and the Buttery Males. Went to Minneapolis George Floyd protest because I already lost one child to racist policy, not again. In Illinois, we pronounce it Illinois. 404 Patreon name not found error. Well, we should. Oh, too bad this wasn't on episode 404. Would have been perfect. Will bump back support after Hong Kong get her fair justice back. Chris Wallace. No, not the one you're thinking of. Make Steve King an author again. Already done. I was going to say you should change that to make Jeff Sessions just a non-senator racist again, but we already did that. You're going to need to update that yet again. Pulling another chair up to the big kids table. Murray Gregerson. The Supreme Court's chicanery makes Saul Goodman look like an amateur. The Venerable Richard Milhouse Nixon. Ian Buckley, donate to restore Florida voting rights at wegotthevote.org/fines and fees. That's a good one there. GiveToModestNeeds.org, GiveToModestNeeds.org. Kristen Daniel, asylum is legal, save DACA, vote blue and dump Trump. Jake Braun, let's have a Sherman statue in Atlanta with an eternal flame. Oh. Christopher Brown, hey, now you're an all-star. Get your vote on. Get sane. Lawfulcopter says Confederate monuments might be their heritage, but destroying the Confederacy is my heritage. Patreon, did you actually save my patron name this time? Can we get cert to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect E3BE answers? Co-ops are a sexy mix of socialism and democracy. Brad in Texas. Rob M. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Zirkle. I was very, very drunk when I changed my patron name last week. My name this week is no better. Remember, Yodel Mountain, Andrew Seidel's butt remembers. Odin wants to defund the Paw Patrol. Me too. I want more briefs. Polly Hernandez, thanks to OA, I got my law GED. My sincerely held religious beliefs preclude covering chemotherapy for conservatives. Emily Rainbow Spence, stocking up on lung injectable bleach. Please keep our patron names socially distanced by at least six spaces, especially this next one. Jason Kopas, Terry Cannon, Republicans are fascists, and Hotspear.com grants six impossible certs before breakfast. Take it away, Andrew Torres.
All right. Thanks to Eastside Seattle, home of OA live shows, quality rugby, and attractively priced commercial real estate. To take donation advice from a podcast, FFRF, EFF, ACLU Modest Needs, and our own damn Patreon. Tulsa Rally ticket holder, Amanda Huggenkiss. Why can't I find Amanda Huggenkiss? Nate Drex, Darth Mandy Pants. So long and thanks for all the starry decisis. The guy who had access to all of Twitter and made only $100,000 off of Bitcoin is the worst criminal ever. 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Save the USPS. They are essential for small businesses. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Jennifer Kratch, Jay Cheever Loophole, Diogenes the Cynic was right, Jeff Gelbeck, let's send unsolicited dicta pics to Naomi Rao, only pics of actual dicta there. Wash your hands, then vote for Joe Biden. Balticate, thinking about bottle shakers and everything killers. I have no idea what that means, but Stephen, thanks. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderbeck, ignore the polls. Vote in numbers too large to suppress. Do not rest until November 4th. Yeah, absolutely. Antifa assistant to the regional manager for Southern Ohio. Well, yeah, let me know when you get your George Soros check, because mine was down this month. So, Andrea, the arbitrary and capricious. Seattle, home of Westland Distillery, tons of corgis, and OA live shows. Moot would be my favorite word if it weren't so redundant. That's excellent. That's so funny. Superior may be going too far, but I'd like a show comparing civil law and common law systems. That's on the whiteboard, man. Eric Altman, me fail presidenting, that's impossible. The landmark Supreme Court case of Kramer versus Kramer, Dustin Hoffman classic. Absion, Therese Chan, Payne's Strumpet, Trambolus, Napoleon the Wandering Gambler, Katabara, Japan. Oxygen dependency is a liberal hoax. Milo Meadsong stands in solidarity with the UW nurses and their union. Gay frogs, murder hornets, and karaoke. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Wait, wrong list. These are the people who sent us crunch wraps. Oh my gosh, that would be so great. We never publicly gave a shout out for the homemade crunch wraps that Teresa posted.
Well, I never actually got mine.
I didn't get mine either. Mine was sent to Iacon. So.
Well, mine was sent to the right address, but I mean, mine was clearly addressed correctly based on the picture, but I never got it. Oh. So. Yeah, maybe there wasn't a stamp. What's the equivalent of a Crunchwrap stamp you put on? Some hot sauce or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, I want extra spicy stamp on mine.
Yeah.
James Call, your dicta gave me ultra-virus. Stay at home. Stay the F at home. Thank you. Ah! Breath. Hopefully I did that justice. Chad T. Anonymous, the Sarah Connor Chronicles is the best Terminator content that isn't T2. I have never seen the Sarah Connor Chronicles, so I should. T2, Terminator, they're both good. WordOrigins.org, both primer and primer are legit pronunciations, but I'm not touching Illinois. Amicus Boxer, closing concessions. Don't stand so close to me, 20, but for a cause charity drive. Liz Weeks. I hope she's just been super excited the past 3 weeks. That would be amazing. Adam Costa. Me Grimlock kick butt. Me Grimlock need new strategy, which is such a great line. Oh, man. Not the best Grimlock line, but you'll have to ask me that at a live show or at a live Q&A. Jay Aldenwalt. All right. Well, that's the show. Thanks for listening and goodbye. Andrew is right wrong, baby. Right wrong, like a record, baby. Right wrong, wrong, wrong. A little dead or alive there. So Big good. Easy blasphemy. Not enough judges overrule objections with roundhouse kicks. The Yodeler is preparing for a fiery reentry. Rhonda 2020, because why the F not? Clown Hornet, I started drinking again. Malika Chandler, Quackin Tush, Soggy Pants, Matthew Vernon, Adopt a Homeless Pet, Napose Declong, and Ear Docking David in Brooklyn, Sakashite Fukasumi, Maybe Limit to Free Speech Should Be Shouting, There Is No Fire in a Burning Theater. Don't Take Legal Advice from Laserbeam Monstrosity, Attorney at Law, Heather L., Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Ally, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow. This was such a great episode covering eminent domain. I'm so glad you finally got around to it. Sam Buck, Mitchell, No Commute So Behind on Podcasts, Staying in the William Howard Taft Hotel Room of Life. Great reference to our Laud Awful movies. Alexandra Chalupa, a.k.a. Natasha Crunchwrap, Michael Conrads, and of course, our all-time great, Conrad Michaels.
Good times. That was fun. That put me in a better mood. Yeah. Thanks for that, top patrons. Thank you. You're the best.
You are.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
T3BE, answer time. Let's hear it.
All right. So this was, you know, a totally straightforward and simple real property.
I'm going to feel like an idiot, I'm sure, after this.
This was a completely incomprehensible real property question that no layperson could possibly get correct, and therefore it pleases me to tell you, Thomas, I'm going to spoil everything in advance. You got this question exactly right.
All right. Picking B. How was my analysis? So, I felt like I got into it a little bit, and there was a chance that I got, but did I luck into it, or did I actually analyze it right?
You analyzed this almost entirely exactly
Holy
correctly.
Holy crap. Yep. What is happening?
It was fantastic.
I'm a lawyer.
Yeah. So here's the question, right? This is a man decides to give his farm to his nephew. And this is the first trick here, because the bar question uses tested and intested, whatever. But remember that the initial question is not about a bequest, right? Is not mm-hmm. about a will, but is in fact just about a simple contract, right? And in fact, that simple contract is, it appears in the answers, what we call a death escrow. Okay. And a death escrow is exactly what it sounds like, right? A death escrow is, hey, I'm going to give this thing to you, and when I die, I want you to give it to somebody else, right? That's what the man has. Then it says,
sorry, but he still has the farm. What do you mean he's going to give it to somebody else?
So the man says, this is the deed to my farm.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm giving it to my
attorney. Has it in escrow, essentially.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Exactly right. I'm going to continue to live on and, you know, utilize my farm and all that good stuff. But when I die, I want you to give it to my nephew. Mm-hmm. And then he adds, oh, by the way, if I change my mind, you know, I ever ask for it back, you're going to give it back to me. Mm-hmm. Right. Next, totally nonsensical, totally bogus distractor. None of the instructions to the attorney were in writing. Utterly irrelevant to the question. You almost went with A, and I was just sitting there like biting down hard, because again, you are correct that when you're talking about wills and deeds and those sorts of things, that there are often writing requirements. But remember, the contract here is the contract to deliver the deed, right? So you're really using what is almost ordinary contract principles with respect to, can you instruct your lawyer to give somebody something after you die? Then next big distractor, shortly thereafter, the nephew died tested, right? And by the way, 100% correct. Died tested means died with a will, right?
Yeah.
In his will, he devised the farm to his daughter. All of this, totally irrelevant to the question. Doesn't matter.
I don't know if that's irrelevant to the question, given that the very question is, must the attorney deliver the deed to the daughter?
Relevant,
but
but not relevant to the outcome, because what you need to know here and what you sort of piece together by intuition is that a death escrow is a valid contract. It doesn't have to be in writing. It can be oral. But for a death escrow to be valid, it must be unconditional.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. Like, I don't feel like he could will something to his daughter that's not really, he didn't really have.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, the question is, does he have it? And so if I go to my lawyer and I say, hey, you know, give the deed to my house to Thomas when I die, and that's all I say, and then I tell you about it, like, you have that. Like, you own that future possessory interest in my home. And you own it in fee simple.
Right? I friggin' nailed this question, everybody. Feels good to get one.
If I go to my lawyer and I say, hey, man, I'm going to give this to Thomas unless I change my mind, well, then I haven't done anything, right?
The lawyer's like, okay.
Right, lawyer's fine. Like, cool.
Lawyer's like, I can bill you for this, right? Yep.
Exactly. And it has no legal effect because I haven't done it because I haven't placed it into escrow. I've placed it into non-crow, right? Like,
yeah.
I've placed it into, I can get this back anytime I want. Well, then you haven't done anything. And that's all the question was asking. This is a perfect example of the kind of question, super complicated, all sorts of crazy conditions. And just if you stop and think about it and apply common sense, you can work your way through it. And you did. And I couldn't be more proud of you.
Well, way to belittle my accomplishment by saying it's actually easy as long as you just think about it for 2 seconds and apply good old-fashioned horse sense.
It's super-duper hard.
I think you needed to be an expert attorney in the field of real property to get this one right. So why don't you hop in your time machine and tell us who else was an expert in real property and is a brilliant lawyer and got this one right?
Well, Thomas, you'll be pleased to know that we got A, B, C, and D answers from our fans. But the first winning answer, I believe, belongs to Joseph Couch, who is running for the state legislature in Nebraska. Anyway, he writes, are they just making up words now? It would be cheating if I looked these up, right? I'm guessing B. It has the fewest words that I don't know, and the nephew died first, so the whole plan is crap. There's no way it was legally delivered, and it needs to be in writing, ? Well, not sure that the mechanism is correct, but Joseph managed to guess B. That's correct. And everyone, give Joseph a follow on Twitter. That is at Joseph4NE, JOSEPHFORNE. And congratulations, Joseph, on being this week's winner, and best of luck to you.
Well, that's our show. We will see you on Friday.
Until then.
He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media LLC. All rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.